You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. Archer goes offline after a security incident. Suspicions of espionage against COVID-19 research. Scammers smish victims with bogus contact tracing messages. Ramsey malware goes after air-gapped systems. AKO ransomware now places a surcharge on deletion of stolen data. Google boots creepware apps with the help of the CreepRank algorithm. Johannes Ulrich explains that when it comes to malicious binaries bypassing anti-malware filters, size matters. Our guest is Pat Craven, director of the Center for Cyber Safety and Education on the security of social media apps. And kooky 5G conspiracists go after cell towers in the U.S. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, May 14th, 2020. The UK-based Archer Academic Supercomputing System has sustained what the network calls a security exploitation that led its administrators to rewrite passwords and SSH keys. They also took Archer offline while the incident was investigated, the Register reports. Archer's managers have warned that computers in Europe may also be affected and that users should not expect access to be restored before tomorrow at the earliest. The Register says that knowledgeable speculation points out that Archer is an obvious resource for research work by computational biologists, as well as those modeling the potential further spread of the novel coronavirus, which also makes it an obvious target for espionage. Yesterday's joint statement by the U.S. FBI and CISA warning that Chinese intelligence services are engaged in a far-reaching campaign to collect against COVID-19 research has elicited the foreseeable response from officials in the People's Republic. It's slander, Reuters quotes a foreign ministry spokesman as saying. Spokesman Zhao Lijian also said that any interference with research ought to be condemned. The joint warning is interesting for the way the Bureau and CISA connect espionage with damage to the research itself. Quote, the potential theft of this information jeopardizes the delivery of secure, effective, and efficient treatment options, end quote. So the risk appears to be more than the usual competitive threat to intellectual property that the U.S. has typically complained of in connection with Chinese espionage. The NHSX-sponsored contact tracing app the scammers are mimicking is now undergoing a closed beta trial on the Isle of Wight. Gizmodo says that the Isle's MP, Bob Seeley, has offered a generally optimistic appraisal of how the app's doing. He notes that it's, quote, throwing up lots of really good information, end quote. Of course, it's only to be expected that any application developed and deployed under emergency conditions would experience problems, and this one is no different. Preliminary reports from users complain that the app is a battery hog and that the permissions it asks for are confusing. Researchers who've looked at the system say that they've found other issues, in particular problems with iOS-Android interoperability. ESET has described RAMSI, an attack designed to exploit air-gapped computers. It's not that RAMSI defeats air-gapping in some spooky or exotic way. Instead, it concentrates on other infection vectors like removable media. ZDNet says that RAMSI appears to collect Word, PDF, and ZIP documents in a hidden folder where they're staged for later exfiltration. Few victims have so far been identified, which suggests to ESET that RAMSI remains in a relatively early stage of development. There's no attribution, but RAMSI appears to share artifacts with Dark Hotel's retro malware. Ransomware gangs routinely steal victims' data to gain additional leverage. Bleeping Computer reports that one gang, the operators of AKO, are now also imposing a surcharge for deleting their copies of stolen files. If you've got school-aged kids, chances are they are home from school these days, thanks to the COVID-19 shutdowns. And if you're listening to this podcast, chances are those same kids have access to a variety of online social media services, which they are using to keep in touch with their friends and classmates during the shutdown. And all that increased time spent online opens up the potential for bad things to happen. Pat Craven is director of the Center for Cyber Safety and Education.
What's amazing, Dave, is that it's possible for our kids to actually spend more time online. You know, who thought that was going to be the situation? And now practically by law, they're supposed to be spending more time online. And so it's just, has ramped up tremendously all the challenges from a safety standpoint with our children and what they're doing. And parents are working from home and they're busy and they're trying to teach kids and homeschool, and there's less, even less supervision than we had in just months ago. So it's been a pretty fascinating thing and a pretty dangerous. The kids are utilizing, and adults as well, we're utilizing different apps, different ways to connect and to be social with people and try to have fun. And there comes risks with all of that.
What about, as people have had to go home and start doing their work from home and using their home networks for business uses, what's the concern of your kids having some of these apps on their devices on a network that's shared with the work you're doing for business?
Well, that's a great point, and something we try to really stress with people is that, yes, you're now sitting at home and you're working on potentially confidential materials for the office, and you're on that same network, on that same Wi-Fi that the kids are out exploring the internet with, and that opens you up to so many more vulnerabilities that we don't think about. That we think of everything being separate, but they're all running through that same router, through that same Wi-Fi, and any kind of breach could come back and actually get into you, into your laptop, and then you eventually even send a document that could be corrupted to somebody in accounting, and it just, the line goes down and down. So it's something that we really have to think about tremendously.
Is it reasonable to do occasional audits of these devices to go through and just check through the apps and see what permissions have been granted and just do a little reality check there?
Absolutely. Even if you've done it at the beginning, if you've gone in and set it to private or that they can't just have anybody part of the conversation, that it's friends only, go back and check that. There's constant updates to these apps. And also, too, of course, the child might switch something, thinking they're making it better and easier to use, and then they have allowed more vulnerabilities. So it is something that we need to do with all of the different platforms that the kids are on, or even ourselves. Again, that we're using all these different apps for social stuff or for work, even to make sure that our settings haven't been changed or adjusted, or a new update came down that set things back to default. So we have to make sure of that.
That's Pat Craven from the Center for Cyber Safety and Education. According to ZDNet, Google has used an algorithm, CreepRank, developed by a university industry team to identify 813 creepware apps for removal from the Play Store. Creepware is similar to spyware or stalkerware, only generally less aggressive. ZDNet explains that it's used to stalk, harass, defraud, or threaten another person, directly or indirectly. And finally, the Luddites and weirdos who've been trashing cell towers in the UK, Belgium, and the Netherlands because they've heard that 5G causes coronavirus have inspired their conspiracy-minded soulmates in the States to take similar action. And all we can do is wonder why it took everybody so long. There have now been incidents reported in the U.S., and the Washington Post says the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is working on an advisory and a plan to help telcos protect their equipment. The Post mentions disinformation in their coverage, but this seems likelier to be a case of misinformation. It also provides a discouraging case study of rumor convergence, the strange bedfellows passionate commitment to a cause can make, the reach of influencers, and the sad futility of much rumor control. One wonders how much the use of virus for both a class of pathogen and a kind of malware have contributed to the popular mania. The Post quotes Eric Van Rongen of the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection as saying, quote, "It is physically impossible that electromagnetic fields transfer particles like viruses," end quote. Needless to say, the activists whacking cell towers know better. Of course, it stands to reason viruses could travel that way. Do your own research, sheeple. And so on. Some of the attacks, sources say, may have been acts of ecotage, taking opportunistic advantage of the pandemic to damage counter-to-nature infrastructure. And there's been no shortage of celebrity influencers sharing the dope that 5G causes COVID-19. The British light welterweight boxer and philanthropist Amir Khan, the singer Anne Marie, responsible for Ciao Adios and Rockabye, among other hits, the actor Woody Harrelson, known for Cheers and Zombieland, have been particularly mentioned in dispatches. For our part, we're going with Mr. Van Rongen over Mr. Harrelson. It's dismaying, if not unexpected, to see how the impulse to do damage like this can be well beyond the reach of rumor control. The Federal Emergency Management Agency and others have tried, but with apparent indifferent success. Alas. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. And joining me once again is Johannes Ulrich. He's the Dean of Research at the SANS Technology Institute. He's also the host of the ISC Stormcast podcast. Johannes, it's always great to have you back. Something you all have been tracking is the use of very large malicious binaries to bypass some anti-malware filters. What's going on here?
Yes. So when you're looking at most malware, it's relatively compact. Like, you know, it's this little basic macro or something like this that then downloads maybe some other little bit of malware, but we're often talking about, you know, a couple megabytes only. Now, what we ran into was a malicious binary that actually was a few hundred megabytes in size. And I've been wondering why, you know, why wouldn't an attacker bother with this? Because that's going to get stuck in mail filters, for example. You know, most mail systems will not deal with binaries like this. Now, this was downloaded via HTTP, but even then, often large downloads like this fail. But the advantage of these large downloads is that a lot of anti-malware systems have essentially an upper limit to what's the largest piece of binary software they're going to inspect. And they're probably going to bypass that limit by essentially just, in this case, adding some kits drawings to the binary.
Right, just some junk to just bulk up the size of the file.
Yeah, like what happened in this case was we pulled it out. It looked like kids' drawings. Could be, well, maybe the malware author wasn't really the greatest artist, but so some scribbles
who
kind
are we
of
to judge,
that,
right?
some faces you could make out and such. But that's basically what made up the bulk of this binary. And of course, you know, any kind of anti-malware, they're looking just at that additional code, would probably not consider it malicious. And that wasn't really the malicious part. The malicious part was, you know, the usual malware code, I think a download or something like this that was attached there.
You know, it reminds me of just in day-to-day use of things like Google Drive. You know, if you have a file that you're storing there and you want to download it, if it's larger than a certain size, Google Drive will pop up and say, you know, hey, this is too large for our usual virus scan. Do you want to grab it anyway? And, well, yeah, I want to grab it anyway. I need that file.
Yeah, and there isn't really another option. Like, it's not that you can say, hey, it's large. Let me wait a couple minutes until you scanned it. Mm-hmm. That's not an option here. It's really just, you know, do you want to get work done or do you not want to get work done? That's sort of right. How that dialogue really looks to the user.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel lucky?
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, ironic course, coming from Google. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Google is a trusted site in some ways. Yeah. So you consider it as more like a document coming from Google in this case versus something coming from an untrusted source.
Yeah. Now, they were not only using large malicious binaries, but you were also seeing corrupt documents as well.
Yeah. That's the other thing we saw. And that's really an issue that keeps popping up, not just with malware, but also network traffic, that software has gotten pretty good in dealing with corrupt documents. Like, I was joking when I talk about sort of web applications, it's pretty much unknown that someone has sort of a completely standard compliant HTML page. You know, they always do something weird and tricky. Here was a Word document that sort of started with a newline character, and turns out certain versions of Word just ignore that newline character and will nicely display the document, which was malicious in this case. But some of the scanning tools, well, they say, hey, this is a malicious. This is not a malicious. This is an invalid document. I don't really bother scanning it. And they may even have problems parsing the document because of these additional characters.
Oh, that's interesting. So the anti-malware software lacks the sophistication that the native software has to deal with a document that's out of spec.
Correct. And since this also depends on the exact version of Word you're running, this is something that one user may open and nothing happens because they're using like an older or newer version of Word, while another user that uses that version of Word that is able to open a document will get infected. So this makes analysis of malware much more difficult. Also, of course, if you're running, and that's sort of how we came across this, if you're running a document in a sandbox, you often use a fairly specific version of Word that just, you know, runs well in the sandbox, that you have sort of instrumented to work well within the sandbox. If that version is not the same that your end users are running, then, of course, you may miss attacks like this.
Right, right. All right, well, interesting stuff as always. Johannes Ulrich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire Daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.